TNKR Media.
Welcome to Inspiring Entrepreneurs Montreal, our 15th season, showcasing stories from outstanding business people presented by BDO Canada. My name is Dan Delmar, along with Mike Newton of BDO. Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, Dan. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks. Today, we're talking about viral businesses, or at least one viral business called Transformer Table. So Richard Mabley is the co-founder and does biz dev for Transformer Table. They went viral on TikTok, and now they're selling at Costco's worldwide. So really, just an incredible example of someone really leveraging virality to sell their products.
It is. It's a fascinating story. And, you know, I think from an older generation perspective, everybody's still trying to figure out how we managed to take off and listen to the story today in terms of how, you know, the virality of TikTok can actually kickstart a business. But it's out there, and it's an interesting angle for those people that like to think that the traditional approach is still the way to go.
And we'll be talking about boards of directors on the show today with Anthony Marinelli from BDO, partner of Assurance, about the importance of boards and how it can often set the tone for the way business grows and certainly provide you with extra resources to improve your skills as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misconceptions on the boards as well. I think a lot of people think they're only reserved for large public companies, but a board can take on many sizes and many shapes. And I think it's if used properly, they can be a really, really strong tool in your arsenal of oversight, but also in creativity.
We'll talk about a couple of viral things first, though, Mike, on the show. One, we'll get to Peter Thiel's viral advice on Twitter for startups in a second. Really interesting, fascinating question. So if you do have a startup, you might want to get a pen and paper handy. The other one is the story from the Gazette here in Montreal about viral businesses and the potential hiccups when growing too quickly. One that I saw this week, a guy who's having a really good time with his donut shop. They call it a Simpsons-inspired snack shop. We won't name it, but obviously, you know, they quadrupled the staffing. They're going really viral on Twitter. When you are in that situation, Mike, you have a really, really hot product. Pre-virality, just in general, what are some things that entrepreneurs have to watch for in terms of growth and in terms of growing too quickly and managing that fast growth?
Well, there's a number of things. So the first few that come to mind, obviously, are going to be people and staffing issues, and what is that going to look like in terms of the expansion? If you're going to expand, and if you're not going to expand, what are you going to do with the people you have, and are they going to end up being overworked, or are they going to end up finding themselves in the center of something? Two, I think the other thing that you've got to recognize is that you've got to maintain the quality of product, and I think, you know, there's for a lot of people, you know, you go away from quality to quantity when you start to get this massive following, and I think the hardest part is to stay true to your product and not lose what is created the buzz to begin with.
You have to stay tuned for Richard Mabley from Transformer Table, because he had a great idea, and it was these tables that sort of literally transform into various different shapes, way more than your old school leaf table. And he had this brilliant idea, and the internet loved it. So the question for Richard now is, well, how do you make that into a real business? We'll talk about it on the show today. You know, he's on the ground doing biz dev, getting deals with Costco. He talks about supply chain and partners overseas. This is someone who's really thinking about the longevity of this business in a deep way.
Yeah, and I think, in not necessarily in Richard's case, but in general, I think a lot of people just, you know, want to expand. They see the buzz, they see the hype, and, you know, you've got to decide what kind of products do you want to be creating, and what kind of message do you want to be sending. I think you see it unfold in front of you in such a high way that the natural reaction is, well, let's just overexpand. And I think you need to look at what quality, what people, and you know what message do you want your market to get?
They're at Transformer Table on TikTok, by the way, 1.3 million likes. So pretty impressive numbers there.
Most definitely. And I think if you what we were just saying, if you look and we listen to him later on, the product selection and actually the slower, not the slower, but the lesser number of products, you'd think with that kind of buzz, you'd just want to be creating stuff everywhere.
We also talk about real estate on the show, Mike, real quick. Any thoughts there? Because Transformer Table is part of a growing trend of smaller furniture, more versatile furniture for smaller spaces, because our cities are getting a bit cramped, I suppose.
Well, cities are getting cramped, and the cost of homes and apartments and condos and the cost of living in general has gone through the roof. So in order to make living space that is more affordable and more accommodated to a group of people that have maybe a few less dollars to be able to be in this market, they're going to end up in some smaller spaces, A. B, I think there's also a push towards this minimalistic approach to doing things, and which, again, in and of itself means less space, but also less things, and how can you get more utility out of less objects?
Well, I want to get to this viral advice from Peter Thiel. He's worth over $7 billion, invested in companies, including Facebook, very early on. And he has these seven questions, apparently. This is from Michael Hook on Twitter, that he asks anyone he's about to invest in, startups. So here are some of the questions. And Mike, you tell me which ones you find most interesting afterwards. The monopoly question: will you be able to capture a large share of a small market? Distribution: how will you deliver your product to your consumers? The secret question: have you found an opportunity that others missed? The engineering question: is a technological breakthrough possible? Durability: will you be able to defend your market position in 10 plus years? People: can you build a team to achieve opportunity you're working towards? Timing: is this the right time to start this business? And one more on beliefs: what important truth do few people agree with you on? Pretty, like, makes you think, hey? Those are some very deep questions.
I was going to say pretty esoteric in some ways, and you look at them and you say they all kind of go in different directions. And if I take one of them, which is the engineering question, can you create breakthrough technology instead of just an incremental improvement? And for a lot of people, I think you look at a product and you go, hey, I could make that product better. Okay, there's nothing wrong with making that product better, but how much better is that going to be, and for how long can you sustain that type of improvement? And the more look, the whole model was always from a tech standpoint: what's the IP, what's the intellectual property, what do you have that's different that gives you value? And I think from a value perspective, creating something new and different is a great opportunity. However, there's been an awful lot of people that have let the inventor go to market with it, and then have made massive upswings in improvement to make a product that much better. I think we're starting to see that just in the EV market right now. I mean, we saw the Tesla come forward and create really the breakthrough technology in all of this. And now look at how many car companies are moving forward. And I think a lot of them are starting to improve that technology.
The last one, I think, was so deep. What important truth do few people agree with you on? That's a heck of a question to ask an entrepreneur, right? I mean, I'm not sure. I might have an answer for that 10 years ago, but do I have one now? I'll have to think about it.
Well, I think that revolves around morals and values, and depending what is the core underneath that's driving your business, and is what is driving you to create this product or this service the same thing that is going to move somebody on the other side to buy it?
On from the world of startups to management, and this is really interesting. This is posted also on Twitter by an economist who works for Indeed, the job posting company, and so they posted the number of manager positions have really jumped in the last few years, 50% really, over the last, judging by the graph, over the last 6-7 years or so. What's going on, Mike? Is this a pandemic phenomena? Why does Canada need so many more managers?
Oh no, this is you got me started on this one, Dan. I could go for an hour on this topic. I think what we have done, and certainly in North America, is we've created an awful lot of people who want to be traffic cops, who want to be managers, and we certainly have too many chefs and not enough cooks, I guess is the old expression. We're driving prices up because obviously management salaries are higher than on the doer salaries. Everybody in today's world wants to lead or manage. I'm not sure if that's that's an ego thing or what it is. Certainly, COVID has made this worse in the sense that people are lacking experience since COVID. But this is a phenomenon that's been going on for quite some time. You know, we used to call it the pyramid effect, right? You had one entrepreneur at the top, and that kind of worked its way down to a wide base of doers. I think then we went to the other pyramid for a while, which was the inverted pyramid, where we had all kinds of people at the bottom that were making the entrepreneurs and the leaders do a lot of the work. We're living in a diamond shape now. There's no doubt in my mind that is there's too few true leaders and entrepreneurs and too few workers for a whole throng of people that are sitting in the middle that are managers. And you know, North America in particular has created a disturbing phenomenon that ultimately is we've got an awful lot of paper pushers and not enough people that are going to either lead or going to spend the time doing the work. And this continues to be a problem. It's also a problem in our manufacturing environments with the inability to keep costs down. You can only have so many people directing so much traffic.
We spoke a lot about productivity on recent shows and the fact that by some metrics we've regressed by about a decade in recent years. This is from also the Indeed Economist on Twitter talking about productivity. He writes, lol, how funny would it be if Canada's productivity woes for the past 3 years were because the number of managers rose by 500K. Is he onto something there?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, all you have to do is walk around an office, and whether that is a professional office or even a lot of manufacturing facilities, and there's just way too many people trying to get somebody else to do the work. You know, I always used to joke that the definition of management was getting somebody to do something they didn't want to do without them knowing that they were actually doing it. Well, how many people can you have following that theory if you're not going to have enough people to actually do the work?
I think we'll really like Richard Mabley. Speaking of that cultural shift, that's someone who really buys into it, kind of an American spirit, really can-do attitude. And Richard Mabley is the co-founder and VP Business Development at Transformer Table. Richard, welcome to CJAD.
Nice to be here.
So the first question is the easiest. What is Transformer Table?
So I'll kind of simplify it. So we're a company based out of Montreal, and we design and commercialize modular pieces of furniture that basically solves people's problems in their homes. Probably the simplest way of, you know, explaining it.
Okay, so I'm going to make you drill down a little bit on it. Modular, I think, is a concept that's been around for a while. So what differentiates you from other sources of modular furniture? And are you restricted to one type? So tables and benches, or are you doing other things as well?
So at the moment, our hero product that we have and that we've been working on for about 6 years is a transformer table, as the name of the company says it. That's an extendable dining table that goes from 18 inches all the way to 10 feet. So you can host all the way up to 12 people. So at a very small, it's that console piece of furniture. You can use it for a number of things. For example, a little console at the entrance, or let's say you don't have a lot of space in your condo, you can put it next to your counter space and then extend it. But the magic lies in two different things, and our competitive advantage lies in how long it extends, but also on the quality of the products that we actually manufacture, which we manufacture ourselves. By the way,
traditionally, a lot of the modular products haven't been the greatest quality, right? I mean, I think we've sacrificed functionality for quality at the end of the day. So you've really tried to push this, and I guess using the local manufacturing, how does that differentiate? What makes it that much better in terms of quality? The materials, the craftsmanship, the design?
So I could talk about the industry as well and a little bit about the history of the company. So at the beginning of the company, when we wanted to look at launching a business on modular furniture, it didn't just appear out of the blue. It was kind of this kind of idea that happened. One of the founders here is Czar. He just had bought a condo. And the condo was so small. And this is very common. Whether we're talking Canada or U.S. or even across the world now, how households are getting smaller and smaller. So you have to kind of get a little bit more creative on the space that you have. So where we wanted to compete was in having a beautiful piece of furniture in your home and usual modular pieces of furniture, you'll see it. It's kind of the rinky dinky kind of little thing and the plastic extensions. And we didn't want to go there. We wanted to really offer a high quality and beautiful piece of furniture in your home, but also offer that versatility that nobody had in the industry. So we all know the furniture industry. We've all shopped at one moment or else in our life for a piece of furniture. And it's a very old industry. And the trends usually go from one color to another, from leather to fabric and the rest. And the modularity and the versatility of the furniture wasn't really taken into consideration when they were developing these new kind of either products or trends. That's where we go in as a new company in the industry. I call us kind of innovative disruptors in an old-fashioned industry. And to be honest, I always kind of, when I go to these trade shows and when I talk to people in the industry, I said, I really hope that what we've created can basically send a trend across the industry. It's like people are looking for something different. They're not looking for the same old anymore. Our lifestyles have changed since then.
Do you find that it brings a different shopper to the table? I mean, I know that when, you know, whatever we moved or bought a new place, my wife would say, let's go shopping for furniture. And I'd say, no, please, can I scrub the toilet instead? It was painful to go out furniture shopping. Do you find that this is now dragged in? I don't want to say the male component, but somebody who may have avoided furniture shopping previously.
Well, I can tell you that 70% of our shoppers are women. They're usually the decision makers in the home when it comes to design, which is not the case all the time. However, our furniture actually brings in a little bit more of the couple in itself, whereas there are opportunities and needs on both sides. For example, I'm a big poker player. I like board games and I like to host. So for me, having a versatile piece of furniture is kind of an essential part of my life and what I love on the weekends, inviting my family. So obviously, when the old industry where you would be shopping for a piece of furniture, you'd have tables that are 6 feet, 8 feet, 10 feet, but that's about it. You got to choose between one or the other. And we offer the opportunity, and this is a great sales pitch. We talked about I shouldn't be selling my product, but I always call my transformer tables the table that the only table you ever need, or it's six tables in one. So you get six different lengths in one single product.
So the transformer aspect, and it's well branded, and I do want to talk a bit about the product, and you can, and please sell a bit if you want to, because I think it's interesting. I have my grandmother's old leaf table, right? You take the leaf out and then you have your extension table. But as you said, yours goes all kinds of different ways, and you have also pieces of furniture that change vocations, really. I mean, you have a desk that changes into sort of like a party table. Tell me about the other products that you're transforming in ways beyond that classic leaf.
So most recently, we launched into the living room. So one of the objectives here at Transformer Table is to go towards I call it Transformer Home concept, where we can offer a hero product, like I said before, but for every room in your home, including outdoors. In terms of new products that we came up with, so we have our modular couch. So where all the different components can come out. So the arms can come off, the back can come off. You have storage compartments in every single section. The covers are interchangeable and washable as well. So when we talk about modular, we also have to talk about versatility and what people need in their home. So I've always had the issues, and I love dogs and I love having animals. So there's always that issue of those covers. And that was something that we thought of. It says, okay, we can offer this beautiful piece of modular furniture. But one of the things that really bothered us in terms of that was, if somebody spills some wine on a cover, what do you do with it? You're stuck with it. Either you try to clean with some special products. But with our products, we offer the opportunity to take those covers off, put them in the wash, and then line dry them, and you can put them back. So they look brand new. So you kind of have a couch that's modular, but also that you can also keep for a lifetime. So another piece of furniture that we just designed was an interesting partnership that just happened with Stella Artois. So I know it sounds weird, Stella Artois, they sell beer. However, Stella Anheuser-Busch reached out to us and they said, "Well, look, I love your work. We'd love to have a little partnership. We have this marketing campaign that's coming out that showcases 9 to 5 to 5 to 9." So they wanted to have a piece of furniture that people can basically convert from a working station to a dining table. So we designed a working station that connects with another working station that makes a dining table that also has that lifts up, and you can store all your screens that can be connected directly to your table. So it's a completely connected table, but also you have the opportunity to store things inside. And obviously, most recently, we just launched our outdoor dining set, which is a game changer in the outdoor industry in terms of furniture. So.
Richard, I want to talk about content marketing, a little bit of
Yes.
digital strategy, TikTok in a second as well. So all that coming up, but real quick on the partnership with Stella. So you mentioned they reached out to you. What was your initial reaction? Like, did you have trouble fitting that? Like, what's a beer company doing with our furniture company? Or was that something that you were really excited about initially?
I gotta say, this is a cool story because so Anheuser-Busch sends us an email. And I'm on the email and some of my other partners. We all thought it was a scam. So we looked at the email and we're like, no, this is not possible. It's this Anheuser-Busch? No, that's not possible. So we all deleted the email. And we're like, ah, let's move on to something else.
Wow.
And a week later, we get another email and we all deleted again. And then it took them about three, four tries. And the last try was like, this is not a scam. Because, and then they called us on the phone afterwards and we had a chat with them and said, okay, this is actually legit. That just tells you that we were so excited about the project because it was unheard of for us first to partner with such a big company like Anheuser-Busch Stella Artois, but also adapting a beverage, alcoholic beverage, to a piece of furniture. And I found that was really, really cool. It was a phenomenal experience, not only for us, but also for the brand. It really upped our brand in terms of our furniture.
So as we're saying, goes beyond that removable leaf in those old school tables, and some of Richard's pieces transform 6 times or more, Richard, and really a lot of different possibilities there. So much so that you've attracted a lot of eyeballs online. And tell me about the role of TikTok and your virality in the success of your business.
I think that it's important to actually go back to the very beginning of the company and how it actually came to be. I mentioned how Czar had a condo and we developed this product, but it had to actually go out there. So one of the first things was another co-founder, Alex, he set up his mother's camera and he did this little kind of video of the table expanding from 0 leaves to 6 leaves to for 12 people. And it went viral instantly. So we put it on Facebook, and within 2 weeks, we had 5 to 6 million views on a product. And that's kind of told us to say, okay, we have something here. Since then, we're very present on Facebook, on Instagram, but also most recently on TikTok. We're doing very well on those different platforms. I think we create content that basically people want to see. They don't see these types of videos, this type of content from an average furniture company. And we've seen other companies go in that direction as well. But TikTok has been really a game changer for us. In the past few months alone, we've had videos to hit 10, 15, some of them over 40 million views. And I think it's just a question of the quality of the content that we have, but also how special our stuff is and how innovative. So it piques people's interest. And I think that's what TikTok is. TikTok is all about small little snippets of information to find out more information. And TikTok was a great platform for us to redirect traffic towards our website, where people were scrolling down. They see this table going from 0 to 12 people. So it's been really a game changer for us. And since the very beginning, virality of our videos has been something to drive sales and drive growth here.
you got to love how market research got done on its own, right? I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, many people spend a lot of time and a lot of money trying to understand what if there's a market out there for their product. Yours just you happened upon it. So, you know, from that perspective, it's great. And I think more people need to understand that those opportunities do exist. I mean, there's only so much you can do on a formal basis here. You you know, get the product out there, let people see it, and let's see what happens. Do you find that because of the product and because of the market that's out there, people are comparing to lower brand, like an IKEA model or something along those lines, because they see it as a do-it-yourself? Like, do you have to spend an extra time or extra effort in terms of focusing on quality?
Yes, absolutely. To answer your question, IKEA will always be kind of a competitor to us. But at the same time, I say not really. And why? I'll tell you why. We're not a company that has 1,000 SKUs. We focus on one hero product by room, and we kill it on that one. So think about it this way. IKEA has, I would think, over 50,000 SKUs on their website or in their store. So their although their marketing spend is gigantic, the thing is, they will never put as much effort and branding on one single product than I can do on my magical product. I can make my product the one-hit wonder, but I can be the one-hit wonder in every single room in the home. So that's where I know where my development and product is always based on. We will make one, but we will make the best one so that we can compete with these big guys, which we do very well.
So talking about the big guys, are you moving product into, I mean, I know you've had some history with Costco. What direction do you take when you're looking at the big box stores and how do you get yourself in there?
So Costco has been a really great partner for us. Make sure that you listen to what I said, partner. It's not a retailer, it's a partner. So you need to take care of that partnership. You need to covet it. It has to be your baby. Especially Costco. Costco is not an easy retailer. If you do well, you'll do extremely well. But it took time for us to do well at Costco. It took us 4 years to even get into Costco US. You need to prove yourself. Over and beyond that, you need to have the logistics. You need to have the manpower. And also, it's all about, you know, trial and error. It's trying things and then failing and trying again. But overall, Costco, if you do well, if you take care of your partner, you can do well like we do. For example, 4 years ago, we launched Costco online. We did well. We supported our partner. They put us in the roadshows in store. Then from there, Costco US found out about us. Then they put us on Costco US special events. And then now I'm in Costco Canada, US, Mexico, Japan, Taiwan, UK. And I have South Korea and Australia that we're launching in the next few months. So, like I said, take care of your partners. They'll take care of you.
Give our audience tonight, what did you do wrong that you learned that you wouldn't do again in that type of environment?
So many things. but I think it's all part of learning and doing better. So I would say one thing that I've done wrong is try to move too fast on launching new products. Sometimes you have a winner, hone in on that winner and make sure that you do well with that winner. One of the things that we used to do is saying, oh, well, we're so excited that, you know, we have a special event coming in the US, and sometimes you jump the gun on inventory. Costco requires you, when you start an event or special event or a month of specials, to have that in inventory. No matter the amount of sales that they have, you have to have that in inventory. So you need to be ready for it. And sometimes one of the mistakes I made in the past, which I learned the hard way, was I would say, well, I can have that in inventory, no problem. And then you launch the event, and then you sell out halfway through. And Costco's like, where's your inventory? I need inventory. So it's like the Costco buyers always tell me. They say, do not promise me the world. Be realistic in what you can promise me.
Richard, talk to us a little bit about the discussion of sourcing and how you manufacture. I know a lot of the development and creativity is done here. Maybe give us a little bit of insight in terms of what the process is.
So we're a vertical company here. We do everything from inventory to design product, and we even have our own studio, local studio here in Montreal. We have 20,000 square feet. So every single video, every single picture that you see out there, we do all everything from A to Z. We do have our own manufacturing plant. It's based out of Vietnam. We have over 350 employees there. And it runs 100% only on our product. We don't have any other client. So it's called, we have three different companies here. So we have Transformer Table, which are a retail arm, so what you know. We have Transformer Studios, which is the studio that we have locally here in Montreal that does all our content. And we have Transformer Robotics. So Transformer Robotics is our fully automated plant in Vietnam, which is interesting to know. Vietnam has over 5,000 furniture plants in the country, but we're the very single only one that make 100% hardwood pieces of furniture that's fully automated. We hardly use any manpower in making our products, and that's unheard of in the industry as well.
And a little more chat for the podcast audience now with Richard. So let's pick up a little bit on the tech, right, Mike? I want to talk about Vietnam and what you're doing in that plant. So you employ over 300 people there, but you're also doing tech. How's the interaction between workers and the AI tech going in your plant?
So it's very unique. It's very difficult. Actually, our president just flew out 2 days ago to go and make sure to see what's going on. We just purchased a number of automated painting machines. So we use electromagnetic paint. So basically, it's fully automated. But obviously, having the right staff and having the right software developers and having the right people in the factory is very important. And I think that's one of the main challenges that we live, whether it's here in Montreal, finding the right talent, whether it's in marketing or in product development or in our studio, but also in Vietnam and finding the right people that have that knowledge. So I think ultimately sometimes we got to steal from other companies over there, but it's competition, you know? And what's interesting is recently we won an award in Vietnam as one of the most innovative, smallest and most innovative furniture manufacturers in the world. So that's incredible. And that was our president, Suslan, that created that from scratch with minimal financing in only 2 years. So in 2 years, we went from zero capacity in terms of containers, and now we can supply between 40 and 60 containers a month of production.
So yeah, I was in Hanoi a couple of months ago with a client, and it was fascinating. I mean, he's got a manufacturing facility set up over there. You know, we've traditionally grown up with the thought process, I guess, in the last 10 years that Vietnam was the low end kind of nuts and bolts kind of manufacturer environment, and I was fascinated at the tech angle that is building in Vietnam right now, and that how the skilled labor and how the technology-driven manufacturing processes are very, very elevated in Hanoi or in Vietnam in general. When you consider, we used to think, well, that's where the cheap toys come from, right? And it's just a whole different world. And I was watching some of the robotic machines in the factory, and it's phenomenal to see. But I will say that the hierarchy of employment within those facilities is very interesting. And it's, you know, where North American, we kind of have this feeling of we have a say no matter what level of employee you have. Yeah, some of the other countries, not so much. But the staffing, there's a lot of people. And I think what we're finally starting to see is a very high level of technology build within Vietnam, and the skilled labor is coming over. And we'll probably see what happened in 5 years from now in China and a lot where the skilled labor is going to create such an increase in cost on labor that somebody's going to be looking elsewhere at some point. It's kind of that evolution of the low cost labor environments.
There's a lot of demand for highly trained talent. Yep. In Vietnam, especially in certain industries, and furniture is one of the biggest industries in Vietnam.
Yeah, and it's difficult because, you know, from the Canadian perspective, we want to bring manufacturing back, we want to bring production back, but you just cannot compete on cost associated with, you know, the employment component where, you know, top employees over there are making a fraction of what we're making in North America. And they've got the technology to boot. I mean, there were a number of furniture manufacturers in Quebec for the longest time. There's not too many of them left anymore.
I would tell you, Mike, I agree with you and I disagree with you at the same time. I agree with you that for the time being, Vietnam is a great location, great destination for manufacturing furniture, especially with the availability of the raw materials that are close by. But think about it. My oak cost me less in Vietnam than in Canada, just to give you an idea. However, with automation and with AI, and I'm pushing for this. And I hope I'm right. Because by using automation and by using AI and using technology as a driver to manufacturing, I feel Canada can become and should become one of the drivers in manufacturing in the world. But if we don't go in that direction, you're correct, we'll never be able to compete.
No, pure labor intensive without the technology use, we will never be able to compete. I totally agree with you that we also need a very philosophical change in the way we look at manufacturing in North America, and particularly in Canada. I mean, we've got the resources, we've got so many of the tools in place, but we need to be looking at this very differently. And I totally agree with you. I would love to think that we can get our thought process in line, but if we don't, we're going to have a major problem. And you know, you look at the jobs that are created under manufacturing. You think of the uptake on the technology. I mean, Dan, on a regular basis, we talk to entrepreneurs in this province about how strong we are technologically. Where do we bridge that gap? Where do we find that ability to not only keep the tech companies local, but get them to employ the technologies so we can manufacture it local?
The knowledge, for example, our manufacturing plant, that knowledge came from here. We just brought it there. And we are looking at different possibilities of building pop-up manufacturing plants a little bit across the world. As you know, as I mentioned, we sell our product across the world. So obviously, logistics, we've seen it during COVID where container prices went up to 20,000. Now it's back to, you know, it's stabilized for the moment. But you don't know what can happen. And, you know, there's this, I call it the Amazon culture that's just came to be, where people want deliveries right away. It's just on time deliveries. That's where you see Prime. I get it the day after. So that requires closer logistics, that requires a lot more kind of local capacity. And I feel that we will be going in that direction. Probably in the next, I'd say 10 to 20 years, or else we're just going to lose those jobs. They're going to go elsewhere.
Yeah, no, agreed. And I, you know, your comment of manufacturing or sourcing closer for the just-in-time mentality, is either going to do one of two things. We're either going to have to get there, or it means our inventory stocks are going to be so astronomical, which at some point carries a cost as well, right? There's a financing cost, there's a warehousing cost. So at some point, and that's why I say we've got to change the way we look at doing things if we're going to succeed in anything other than the resource-based manufacturing side of what this country has become known for.
100%. I agree.
Richard, one last question from the marketing content perspective. And I asked this of some entrepreneurs who have had success both digitally and also later in the real world, so to speak. What advice would you give to those who are going viral, but then also have to get to a viable place in business? How do you go from viral to viable?
Hey, luck? I'm
It's
just joking.
more
But
than that.
not really. It's more than that. I think is capitalizing on those opportunities. I think that's important. It's going viral is one thing, but it's being able to capitalize on it and making those sales. I think that's where the big challenge often happens, and the disconnect between the social media aspect of it and the virality of certain things, and basically correlating that into how do I make sales with that? How do I bring traffic to my website? And I think that's where the mix between science and the magic comes into play, where you have the magic of bringing all these people to this video. But what is the science? Where, how are you going to bring that magical virality and bring it into a science and actually having them, you know, go to cart and purchase your $2,000 or $3,000 item? So I can't speak for all the other industries. I can speak for ours and what makes us different and unique and what makes us have people pay a premium for our product is first our innovation. We're unique in the market. And number two, I would say content. Have amazing content that fits your brand, but also fits your product. What does your customer, what's your customer, what is he looking for? Is it a problem that he's looking to solve? Then hone on that. Is it something that he needs to add in his, then hone on that. Hone on the assets of your product, hone on the assets of your brand to make those conversions work. But I'll tell you one thing. Again, it's trial and error. We probably went viral 1% of all the videos that we put out there. And I'm being very generous. We had one video that hit 131 million views on Instagram last year. We were the most viewed product Instagram reel of all times, even more than Kim Kardashian, the rest. But I'll be honest, when you look at the sales conversions, it was extremely average considering the traffic, because the traffic was not necessarily coming in from US or Canada. They were coming in from the Middle East. So that's where we started maybe looking into launching our product into the Middle East. So maybe not the sales, but we just got a new opportunity and a new market that could be interesting for us. So like I said, honing on the data, that magic, that science, but also honing on that product and what you know and how you're selling your product. So
okay, very interesting.
It's the why at the end.
Thanks, Richard Mabley. Excellent. And you do a great job as a spokesperson for Transformer Table. We'll have your one piece of advice for inspiring entrepreneurs on the way. But first, let's check in with our BDO specialist. Anthony Marinelli is a partner at Assurance at BDO Canada, here to talk about boards of directors and why they can help your business succeed. Anthony, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dan. Thank you for having me.
And Mike, just off the top, you know, a board isn't for all companies at the start, right? At some point, you have to get big enough to, necessitate a board.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to a board. And you know, we traditionally see a board of directors and we think of, you know, big business, big public companies, shall I use the term antichrist, I guess, in today's world of that kind of feeling of 1% board of directors snoot. The reality is they have a huge play in a lot of family businesses and smaller businesses. And Anthony, you know, when you look at this, When is your business ready to have one? I mean, I don't think it's necessarily purely a revenue number. I think it's a functionality of where you want to go. What are some of the things you're looking for?
So that's a great question, Mike. I know in certain situations, it's clear you need a board of directors. There's regulatory for public companies, for example, you need to have a board of directors. There's no question there. But there are other situations where you have to make a decision as an organization whether or not you want a board. And I've seen small companies, I've seen startup companies who have a pretty experienced board of directors because they want to make sure that they get all the counsel and advice needed for them to succeed. So I've seen smaller companies have board of directors. I've seen companies who are perhaps looking to sell, looking to go public, have board of directors because that helps ensure proper governance. And governance, we know, is really critical today, especially when we think about ESG. So that's other situations. And yes, larger corporations normally, and not just corporations, organizations have board of directors because they are more sophisticated. They have more complicated issues to deal with. There is more risk, and therefore having a board of directors to offer some advice and counsel is critical.
Yeah, I think often a board is misconstrued in the sense that it's there for checks and balances and to keep everybody in line. But realistically speaking, certainly in the smaller entrepreneurial sector, and I don't mean, you know, 500 $500,000 businesses. I'm still talking about the multi-million dollar businesses. It's an opportunity to create multiple touch points in terms of insight and ideas. And it's not just for checks and balances. And I think, Anthony, you look at this, and I think this is one of your big is this discussion of, multiple sources of information for people.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. I think a board has to look at the big picture, what's happening in an organization, and offer that, be a sounding board for the leaders of the organization, and offer guidance. And if I think about what guidance they need to offer, for me, the most mature boards deal with things like corporate strategy, risk management. They deal with things like oversight on financial integrity. And the word oversight is important, not getting into the details, but thinking big picture, whether there are risks in the company, and also making sure there's ethical conduct within our organization. So I do think that the board needs to work closely with the CEO or leadership of any organization to make sure that they do offer that level of counsel to the leaders.
Yeah, so a couple of things you mentioned, the objectivity and this independence component here in terms of an oversight function. I think you see boards having different purposes for different organizations, right? I mean, you'll see them in a nonprofit environment, you'll see them in a public company environment, you'll see them in a private company environment. Talk to us a little bit about this independence and objectivity as you get into the term governance, which is obviously a huge buzzword these days.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things for me here that are important, and I think each board is a little bit different. So we have some boards where we have what we call internal board members. So that's people within the organization who sit on the board. And I think that's where independence, objectivity becomes even more important, because it's very easy for employee of an organization who might sit on a board to focus on areas that affect that person day to day. So whether their department or their friends within the organization. And that can't be the case, because a board is there to look at the big picture. So I think that's where you need a strong board chair who always thinks about independence, objectivity, big picture, in order to make sure that we don't have issues of independence, objectivity. And I think that's why it's really important for any board to make sure they have the external board members in place as well. Make sure they have people from outside the organization who have seen things differently in the world, who have had different experiences. So that's critical. For organizations that don't have external board members, I strongly recommend you start thinking about how you can include them into your board, because they bring that diverse viewpoint. And Mike, I do want to touch about the importance of having a diverse board, making sure that diversity is what boards are thinking about. I think, and diversity could mean gender, could mean cultural, could mean race, but really it's having diverse thoughts, having diverse skills and experiences. And that's just so important, because if you have a board where everyone agrees, there's really no point of having a board. You want to have those different viewpoints. You want to make sure you have the right skill sets on the board, and different organizations have different needs. So make sure you know what your needs are for your organization. And lastly, also, I know I'm going a bit off topic, but what's really important to make sure you have a board doing what they're supposed to be doing is having psychological safety in the room, and making sure that board members can talk freely about what they think, even if they're the only person who feels that way. So I think that's critical. And I'll give you an example of what we do on the boards I work with. If we have a topic where everyone agrees, we'll ask someone to play the devil's advocate, to say, give us what the other viewpoint might look like so we can have a discussion on it. And that's critical for a board to be effective and also to remain independent and objective.
Sounds like you need me on a few more boards just to play devil's advocate with you.
Yeah, Mike.
Anthony Marinelli, assurance partner at BDO Canada on boards. Thank you very much, Anthony.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And as we come to the end of our show, let's turn to our entrepreneur, Richard Mabley of Transformer Table, and ask him for his one piece of advice for inspiring entrepreneurs. Richard, what do you think?
That's an excellent question. I would tell you, and this is a conversation I had with my girlfriend this morning, actually. It's hard to be an entrepreneur. I think it's not said enough that it comes with sacrifice. It comes with difficulties. It comes with being the master of nothing, but you have to be the master of all. So it comes with so many challenges, so many failures. But, you know, being able to see those smaller victories really go far. So I think the best advice I can give to people is if you're going to be able to go through those rough waters, it's one of two things. Start a business with the people that you love, or start a business in something that you love. Because if that's not the case, if it's just about the money, you won't last. You won't last a year. And the thing is, I went through all those hurdles. And the only reason why I did that is because I really freaking love what I do.
And it shows, Mike, there you go. Another entrepreneur goes viral online, but has the system in place to make that viable business.
Most definitely. And I think the one thing that I took out of that last piece, obviously, is one of the words we've used many times is passion. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, without passion, you can't ride the ups and the downs. You certainly need to be able to get up every morning and see a bigger picture. And I think money is a motivator for only so long, so, as Richard says. So, yeah, I like what we heard today. And, you know, as I've said many times before, I love when our guests just validate some of my thoughts. So thanks, Richard, for that.
It's my pleasure, Mike. Hey, I'll come in and validate all your stuff whenever you want. Happy to come back.
Thanks very much, Richard. Well done. A reminder, you can subscribe to Inspiring Entrepreneurs as a podcast on iHeartRadio, Spotify, or your favorite platform. And we'll see you back here next week. Thanks, Mike.
Production of TNKR Media. Good talk.